Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Connecticut's fire danger. It's currently listed as extreme to high. That's according to the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, Division of Forestry. The fire danger is extreme in South Middlesex and South New London counties. Here in Fairfield and New Haven County, the fire danger is high, which is nothing to feel comfortable about, even though we're not extreme. It's still a big threat and something we really need to discuss this morning. So I thought, who better to have on than Fire Chief Lance Edwards out of the city of Bridgeport. What's up, Chief? How are you?
Good morning. I'm so glad to be here with you, Melissa. How's everything?
I can't complain, Chief. I have to say, I do love the cool, nice conditions because usually August is like brutal for me. I don't like the extreme heat, so I've been loving the nicer weather. However, I miss the rain, and I think our whole state misses the rain an awful lot.
Yeah, we're due for a really good soaking.
I mean, tell us, you know, what ends up happening. Like, what does this typically mean for Connecticut? You know, when you hear high to extreme, you know what I think of? I think of the bear, Smokey the Bear, and the risk of forest fires. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I always think when I hear extreme to high.
Exactly. So Connecticut Deep monitors the forest fire danger daily. And as you mentioned a few minutes ago, there's five different categories. And right now you have Southern Middletown and Southern New London counties in the extreme category. Fairfield County is currently in high. So we have two more categories to get to extreme, but being in the high is certainly nothing really to laugh at. We still have to be very diligent and very careful about how we utilize campfires and fire pits in the backyard and just being mindful of just flicking cigarettes out of the car while on the highway. So we're very concerned about the dry climate that we're in right now because I don't see any significant rainfall forecast in the near future. So I think all of the municipalities in Fairfield County are paying very, very close attention to this right now. It's a significant issue.
And I remember last summer there was, it was either Fairfield or Westport, where there were brush fires right along I-95, and it happened multiple times. And I know earlier this week, same thing happened in Shelton. There was video of three different brush fires. So do you think that's pretty common, I would say, right? I mean, in the summertime, unfortunately, we do see these brush fires happen, but how? How do they happen?
Well, and actually, we've had a couple here in Bridgeport along Route 8 and 25. And usually when you have a brush fire along the highway, usually that's from a discarded cigarette or a cigar, especially a cigar. A cigar has a tendency to smolder a lot longer than a cigarette. And keep in mind, most people who are buying new cars, there's no ashtrays in the cars. So people are just flicking the cigarettes and the cigars out of the window. Mm. And with this dry climate, it's very easy. It's like it's like timber out there. So the grass and the brush out there ignites very quickly. So we've responded ourselves here in Bridgeport to probably three or four brush fires along Route 25 and Route 8. So for the listeners out there, be very careful, especially if you have a new car and you want to enjoy a smoke. Think of another way to discard your cigarette or just wait till you get to your destination.
Yeah, the cigarette thing drives me nuts, Chief. I've got to be honest with you. So when I was a kid, I remember the cigarette discard in dry conditions. It was actually, I was kind of impressed. It was highlighted in a childhood movie. I don't know if you or your kids or your grandkids have seen Homeward Bound 2. So the first one, obviously, everybody has seen. But in the second, the sequel to Homeward Bound, there's literally a person who just, you know, just throws their cigarette out the window. And it's a vision in my head that I remember being like 10, 11 years old and seeing this movie and just sobbing because the entire house right there on the corner where the grass caught fire or whatever it was, the brush caught fire, the entire house went up in flames. And, of course, you know, the dogs were able to go in and save the little kid and everything. Like, it was a movie. But I remember thinking, like, wow, what a smart thing to do to teach kids at a young age the dangers of just discarding your cigarette butts out the window and thinking nothing of it. But an entire house went up in flames. Like, that's just an image I've never been able to get rid of since I was a kid.
Yeah, it doesn't take much. And keep in mind, earlier this year, Middletown, about 250 acres burned. And I believe so this year in the state of Connecticut, 300 acres have burned. But it really doesn't take much for that number to double or quadruple.
That's so scary. And we're talking this morning to the fire chief in Bridgeport, Lance Edwards. And Lance, what about people who go out in the woods, they go to hike? I know when we were younger, we used to, you know, make small fires like campfires for Girl Scouts or, you know, people who just like to go out and they're outdoors men and women. Right now, would you probably, you know, word to the wise, probably not a good idea to be making bonfires right now?
Absolutely not. Connecticut has a lot of residents that enjoy camping based on the landscape that we have here. But if you're going to go out, please be very careful while cooking and enjoying your campfires. I certainly wouldn't recommend starting a campfire now because it's just too dry. And it's probably impossible for you to carry enough water out into the woods in the wilderness to extinguish your fire. I will say this, if you're going out and you just happen to be in a very, very isolated area and you're like, you think it's perfect for a campfire, at least bring a shovel with you. Because the shovel goes a long way, because you can smolder a lot of fire by just digging up the dirt with a shovel. You can't carry enough water with you, but you can certainly carry a shovel or two to help extinguish a fire. And also be careful of discarding any hot charcoal. That's a big danger also. They smolder for a very long time, and just be very conscious and diligent of the area around your campfire. You have to be very, very careful.
That's an interesting point, Chief. So when you say bringing out enough water, give us an idea. Like, how much water do you need to, I mean, obviously every fire is a different size. So do you have any facts or figures to kind of give people an idea of, like, how much water would you need to put out, like, an average size campfire?
To be honest, I would say if you could carry 5 gallons of water and a shovel, that would go a long way. But I can tell you, if you're walking deep into the woods, that 5 gallons of water is going to be heavy. It's 40 pounds.
Yeah.
So you get, an eighth of a mile into the woods, that 40 pounds is going to wear on your body. Mm-hmm. But that's why I say it's probably more important for you to carry a shovel. Shovels are light, and you can carry two people going out there with you, opposed to trying to carry water. Because most people have, like, a water bottle with them. You're not going to extinguish much fire with a water bottle.
Bridgeport Fire Chief Lance Edwards is here talking about fire safety, fire dangers across Connecticut. You know, Lance, I'll always have you on in December when people start getting their Christmas trees. And then I have you on later in the spring when people save their Christmas trees and want to burn them and see the, like, 6-foot, 10-foot fires. I bring that up only because if people do, for some reason, still have their very dry Christmas trees, I'd imagine now more than ever, please, please, please don't burn them. Please don't.
Absolutely not. Take them to your local refuse center.
Take them to what?
The transfer station.
Oh, get rid of them.
Yes, please.
Yeah. I mean, what about like really, really dry wood, though? Does it have the same effect as, like, those Christmas trees? I mean, those things light up in like 10 seconds. It's pretty unbelievable.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The drier the fuel, the easier it is to ignite. So be very, very careful and diligent about wood and brush and things of that nature. You have to be very, very careful, especially if it's out and exposed to this high humidity. It'll go up like a Christmas tree, literally.
So what about that? That makes me think about people's grills and if they're too close to the house.
Well, we all like convenience, so we all have a tendency to keep our grills a little too close to the house because no one wants to walk 50 feet out into their backyard. But most people, you'll notice, will have their gas grills or charcoal grills on their wooden deck, and the wood is combustible, and they really should be away from the home, probably on some cement or grass. At least 50 feet away from the structure, you have to be very, very careful, especially for those that like the old school charcoal grills. Usually when you're done with your picnic, your barbecue, you have a tendency to empty out your charcoal, and these things smolder for a very, very long time. And if you have a tendency to put it too close to even a wooden fence, you're probably going to wake up to something that you did not anticipate.
Is there anything, Chief, that people should bring with them, you know, like on a daily basis? Like, I always feel like I have the most random things in my purse, you know, Band-Aids, pepper spray, random stuff. But if you come across, like, I guess if you come across, like, a brush fire or you are in the woods or something like that, if you come across, even at the beach, like, I've noticed people will do the bonfires at the beach sometimes in the sand.
Yeah.
If you need to put out a fire, is your best plan of attack just 911, or is there something you could do in the immediate moment that you're seeing it happen?
It really depends on the severity and the size of the fire and basically the amount of training that you have. The number one important tool that you can carry with you is a cell phone to call 911, to call the professionals who are trained to deal with it and have adequate water supply. The one thing we don't want you to do is try to extinguish a fire that you may think is small, and God forbid the wind shifts, and next thing you know, you're trapped. So I think you're much better suited to call 911 and leave the fire to the professionals.
This probably sounds dumb, but you know what? I'm going to ask it because there are no dumb questions on this show. Are there certain things you should never, ever, 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 ever throw on a fire? And I know, obviously, we've talked about like sand, dirt, water, obviously, which maybe some people didn't realize you could, you know, put sand or dirt on a fire and it will help the situation. Are there things you should never use to put out a fire?
Any type of accelerant, any type of, and you just mentioned that there's no such thing as a dumb question. You'd be surprised of the things, because usually in an emergency, when you get excited, people have a tendency not to think rationally.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking. Yep.
That's why I say you're best suited to call 911 and leave it to the professionals, because we're trained to think and operate in those particular situations. But do not ever utilize any type of accelerant on a fire, because it's just going to magnify the issues. Because people just aren't thinking. They just see a can and they assume that it's some type of liquid, not realizing if it's a red can, it's probably gasoline. But you'd be surprised what people do in the moment of an emergency. They're just not thinking rationally.
Yeah. Well, and I think to myself, like, I mean, I guess, like, if you have, like, a can of soda or you have beer nearby, and I'm just thinking of, like, things that should never be thrown on a fire, or does it make a difference? I don't know. Because people will panic. That's just it. Especially if they're intoxicated.
Exactly. And usually, at a campfire, usually that goes hand in hand with alcohol. That's why I say you're best suited to call 911, especially if it's starting to get bigger and you notice that, and it's around any type of dry grass or brush or anything like that. Try to get away from the area and call 911 immediately. Don't try to extinguish that fire by yourself or with your friends, especially if there's a large group of you and you're all intoxicated. That's a recipe for disaster.
Mm-hmm. Amen to that, brother. Chief Lance Edwards, always appreciate having you on the show. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Not a problem at all. Good talking to you, Melissa.
Always great to talk to you, too. Bridgeport Fire Chief Lance Edwards right here on WICC. The pay gap between men and women starting to form very early in professional careers, just 3 years after graduation. That's according to a new Wall Street Journal analysis of data from 2015 and 2016 graduates, and nearly 75% of undergrad and graduate programs across 2,000 universities. The median pay for men topped that of women 3 years post-graduation. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the wage gap that we've been seeing between men and women. And this morning, back on the show, Julie Balke is here. She is our career strategist on the show. Good morning to you, Julie. Thanks for stopping by.
Good
How are
morning.
You?
Good morning. Good, Melissa. How are you this morning?
I'm good. You know, Julie, this is something I talk a lot about on my show, because I have seen it in my own line of work that I've been in television where male reporters have made a little bit more than me as a female reporter. And we had the exact same job, did the exact same things, had the same awards, you know, like resume to resume. We looked about the same, but we were different genders. And we've seen this in many lines of work. And it's interesting because as a nation, we're working so hard to bridge the gap between men and women and bridge the gap between races and cultures and things like that. But the wage gap thing, I'm very astonished that in this day and age, we still have such a huge difference when you've got two people doing essentially the same thing, but they're different genders.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of factors that go into this. And certainly one of them is women are generally less willing to negotiate at the beginning for a better salary. They are, you know, in general, we are more afraid of being not liked, afraid of having the offer rescinded, afraid of asking, for what we think we're worth. And so that is certainly part of it. There is, you know, when I my last job in human resources, which feels like a long time ago, and I guess it was, it was in the mid to late 90s. I remember we were talking about making offers. And the CEO of the company said, well, does he have a family? And that was his way of saying we need to pay him more because he has a family. And mm-hmm. so there's still this ribbon of kind of discrimination, assumptions that men need to make more because they're going to be supporting a family, even though we're in a completely different world.
But that's so funny because
it's a multifaceted situation.
That's a really weird, I didn't mean to cut you off, but like that's so bizarre to me, only because, you know, we're also living in a time where all we talk about is how do we get women back in the workplace because they're working moms. So that's weird that we wouldn't assume the same thing, that she's probably supporting her family or she's probably contributing to supporting her family. That's so weird.
Yeah, so it is. And it's one of those things that you can't solve it with one wave of the wand. There's this thing called also that loosely referred to as the motherhood penalty, which means that, well, you know, she's just going to quit in a few years and have babies anyway. So why do we want to give her more upfront? And so we carry these biases around and we aren't even aware of it. And so those are three things that play into it. But another thing that was very interesting about this study that the journal did was they followed graduates of Georgetown's business school, undergrad business school, and Michigan's law school. And they followed these graduates, males and females, and compared them for the first 3 years. And they found that even if they started at the same salaries, and businesses are usually pretty darn good at having like one starting salary across the board for people coming out of school. But then what happens after that? Men negotiate more aggressively. I think we generally know that women in general are at least, you know, the older generations and you know, just I think gender-wise across the board, we are sometimes less willing to put ourselves out there and ask for what we know we deserve. We'll take what's offered. Where men are willing to say, nope, that's not going to do it. And, you know, that, so there's some courage, some aggressiveness, some assertiveness that goes into that. But this study showed that a lot of the issues start when the young men and women are choosing which path within their profession to take. So the law school graduates, men were more likely to go to firms which pay a lot more. Women were more likely to go to nonprofits, mission-driven type of work.
Okay.
And so we select sometimes, you know, the thing that is going to pay us less because it's more aligned with what we want to do, with what we believe in. But then there's also that vicious component there of, I don't think I can do this harder job. Men are more likely to say, I can do it, I want to do it, and then go in and figure it out. Where women are much more likely to say, ooh, I don't know how to do that. If I don't know how to do that right now, then I'm afraid I'm going to go in and get in over my head. And so that is just, that's just this thing that just goes through us, and we see it play out again and again. Mm-hmm. You know, I always joke with my women clients, or when I'm doing professional speaking, I'll say, you know, men are likely to, if there's a job description and it says these 10 things are required, a woman will look at that list of 10 things and say, oh crap, I only have 9.
Mm.
Men will look at it and say, I have 4. I'm golden.
We're good.
And they'll get
true.
It.
It's
you
true.
Know, very often they'll get it. It's and true. So I don't say that to criticize men. I say that to say, as a woman, if you've got to step up and swing harder sometimes and say, you know what? I've got 7 or 8 out of these things, or 5 or 6, but this job seems really appealing to me. Mm. I'm going to go ahead and apply and figure out what it takes to get up to speed as quickly as possible. And so there's this, you know, belief in, you know, this self-confidence, this belief that men seem to have professionally that, you know, frankly, sometimes unfounded, that women don't. And sometimes some of those women should. So it's, you know, it goes way, way back and very deep.
Interesting. And Julie Balke is here. She's our career strategist on the show. And we're talking about the wage gap that still exists among men and women in the workplace. So you know what else I kind of thought about, Julie, as you and I are talking about this with women? I know for myself, I am not a very good advocate. I never have been. Always very intimidated. Never really feel that I'm as great as I could be or compared to other people. But you know what I also have noticed about myself that I have to get over in, you know, in the years that I've worked in this industry, is I always expect for people to recognize when I've done a good job. You know what I mean? Like, I think yes. that idea of, you know, when you grow up in a household and your parents are like, whoa, way to go with that report card. I feel like we carry that into our workplace where it's like, whoa, my ratings are great, or hey, our clients love me, or hey, you know, people keep coming back on the show. I booked this show out every day. Like, I don't know why, but I have this mentality. And I have to say, my company I currently work for is very good about this. They're actually very complimentary, which is nice. But in a lot of my time, especially in TV, nothing. Crickets. I mean, nothing. I'd have no idea where I stood. Even if you got an award, it was like, well, we expected that. So I want to know if that's something else that women kind of struggle with in the workplace, that mentality of like, well, they should be offering me a raise. I mean, I've kind of earned it.
Yeah, it's we have to advocate for ourselves. And the danger there is that sometimes we wait until we're really, really frustrated. Then it becomes emotional. And nobody reacts well to your emotion. Sorry. And so I think you have to look at your career as the business of you. And you and you alone are responsible for advocating for yourself, for knowing what your worth is, for asking for it, instead of waiting for somebody else to recognize it. And so when we sit there for so long and we're the ones doing the work in some cases, you know, in some departments or in some cases, and we're waiting for somebody else to give us a raise, give us a bonus, and instead it seems they just pat us on the head. And so that advocating for ourselves has to start very early. So when you are negotiating for your first job or for a job, you have to get as much as you can in your starting salary, because most of us just get kind of, you know, 3 to 5% salary increases, merit increases after that. And so when you get your base as high as you can going in, then even if you just get those 3 to 5% increases, those really add up over the years because you're getting those increases on a bigger base. So the first thing you have to do is when you go into a new job, know your worth. There are sites like salary.com, Comparably. You can look on LinkedIn. You can look at job postings and see which ones are similar. There's a lot of ways to find out what the salary range is for what you're looking for. And if the salary range is 60 to 70, let's say, and you've got 8 years experience, do not take 60. You know, you have to know what you're worth. You have to ask for it in a business way. Make a business case. The fact that you need more money or your childcare costs have gone up or the gas prices have gone up is not the problem or concern of your company. Your worth, your value, if you don't know it, if you can't state it, and you can't ask for a salary that's commensurate with your worth to the organization, no one is going to do it for you. They're just going to think, well, you know, it is kind of a squeaky wheel gets the grease thing. And so you've got to become a squeaky wheel when you know that you are highly valued, that people are, that you get a lot of great feedback, that your performance appraisals are good, your customers love you. If you're getting good feedback, you have leverage. And so go out and get that information as to what you are worth, what other roles like yours are paying. It's so easy to find these days. And then go in and make a business case and say, look, here's what I've learned. I've been here this amount of time. I get great feedback, blah, blah, blah. And this is what is being paid. You know, let's talk about how do I get up to the salary or beyond in a reasonable period of time. Sometimes companies can't bring you up immediately, but you have to go in and insist on and ask for, you know, to be paid what you're worth. And it's just, you know, if you don't do it, to wait for somebody else to do it is simply foolish.
It's a waste of time. Julie, I'm curious, what if you get a hard no? What if somebody you're talking to this morning is like, look, I put it all out on paper. I know what I'm worth. I went, I presented it, and sorry, we just can't afford to give you a raise. What do you suggest for that person?
So the first thing I would say is, okay, let's put together a plan for the next 6 to 9 months, the next 12 months. Maybe there's some way you can be bonused to make up for it. Let's say the company has frozen salary increases. Let's say they're in an industry that's struggling right now. Mm-hmm. What can you do to increase your bonus pool, to tie your work to some sort of compensation, some sort of additional compensation? What can you get in writing? We'll review this again in 6 months. Look, if you like where you're working, you love your work, it's a great commute, you love your boss. In other words, if all other things are good except compensation, there are times in our lives when that is enough for us. But if it's not, I think you have to be prepared to make a case, prepared to ask for some sort of, you know, some way to fix it over a set period of time, or you have to look to leave potentially. And I think we're so hesitant to do that because we get like, oh, they're going to be so mad. Who cares? You know, this is about you and your career and your worth. And so, you know, sometimes if, you know, if you can't get what you need and you're not generally happy there anyway, it really is time to go someplace else. And or at least to start exploring your options. And what happens, Melissa, unfortunately, is when we go out and we start exploring our options, we start interviewing at Company B and Company C, then we come in and give our notice. Our boss is like, well, wait. You know, let's talk. Let's see what we can do. So sometimes, I hate to say it, it takes the threat of losing you to move your company to action. But I don't recommend that you go in and bluff because they just might take your bluff.
Yeah.
So you want to always operate above board, know your worth, and be willing to have those hard conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true. And Julie Bauke, who is the president and chief career strategist for the Bauke Group, and somebody who I've very much valued having come on this show often and giving just business expertise and ways to handle ourselves in the workplace. I thank you so much for popping back on the show.
You're welcome. Sure, anytime.
Love having you. Julie Bauke here on WICC, and we'll have Julie back on, I'm sure, in a week or two. Added to the list, another thing that's going to make food expensive. We were talking about how California growers, they make up about 25% of our tomato produce, essentially. So anything that we have tomato in, your ketchup, your salsa, your spaghetti sauce, or your tomatoes. Got to remember the tomatoes. That's all going to cost a lot more, as if inflation wasn't already, you know, killing us. We've got this drought that's going on. It's even worse over in California. They are desperate for rain, like really desperate. This is the worst it's been in like 1,200 years or some such information that we're getting from California, which means that our tomatoes are going to cost us more. Anything with tomatoes in it going to cost you more. Like I said, inflation, it's already a problem with food, and it seems like prices are just continuing to go up and up and up. So I thought, let's talk to a senator representing Connecticut and somebody also who is very familiar with food prices because he has a domino effect for him because he also owns a restaurant and has for quite some time. And I'm talking about State Senator Paul Formica, who is here this morning. He represents the 20th District here in Connecticut and also has been the owner and operator of Flanders Fish Market and Restaurant, which I am very familiar of, for nearly 40 years. Good morning, Senator. Thank you for being here. Senator Formica, are you there? Don't do this to me, Senator, please.
I'm sorry. Yes, I am. Excuse me. Hi.
No, you're fine. You're fine. Did you mute yourself? I tend to do that.
I did. I didn't want if you were on the news. I wasn't sure if I was coming on. But good morning to you and good morning to everyone, and I apologize for that.
Oh, don't apologize, please, Senator. I literally do that all the time to Paul in the afternoons because I come on his show and I always mute myself and then I forget that I'm on mute. So it's all good, my friend.
Yeah.
I am so glad you're here this morning. You know, I wanted to talk first from a restaurant standpoint. I know typically when we hear Senator, we're going to go right to law, but I'd rather talk actually a little bit about what you're seeing personally at Flanders Fish Market and Restaurant. How has inflation impacted you and your employees and I would say the trickle-down effect for the food that you guys offer, especially being seafood? Like, love your lobster rolls over there. Like, how has the inflation impacted you guys?
Well, thank you very much for the kind words. You know, we've seen a huge impact on inflation in any number of ways, not only just food, but, you know, labor costs and fuel costs and everything has just been affected. And, you know, I was sitting here, you know, this morning early looking at the computer, looking at the bills to pay. And you know, every week it seems to pop up just a little bit more. Things are just a little bit more expensive. And that, you know, that creepy crawl upward is, I think, what's, you know, so harmful to everybody, all the businesses and residents in the state. And so... we're adjusting our menu prices to the best we can on a weekly, sometimes daily basis. But there's only so much you can charge for certain items. So sometimes you just have to swallow the increase.
And I, you know, in as a restaurant owner, again, it depends on what you're serving. But for example, I was saying seafood. I know from restaurants here in the New Haven County area, things like lobster, twin lobsters that used to be a summer thing that they would do, like they can't do or they haven't been able to do because A, inflation, and also they just have no access to them. So it's been a rough go for many restaurant owners. But even when we talked this morning about like tomato prices going up, the fact that you're going to spend more on your sauces and on things like the ketchup on tables at burger joints, anywhere you go, like that's just insane. It really is just about anything that the prices are insanely increasing, it seems like.
Yeah, and tomatoes are one of those items that touch a lot of different recipes throughout people's restaurants. Doesn't matter what kind of restaurant you really have, people are going to feel that effect. You mentioned lobsters. You know, 6 or 7, 8 weeks ago, you know, no more than that, we were paying almost $20 a pound for a live lobster.
So then what do you charge people? Because that's crazy. Wow.
What do you charge them? You almost charge them the same thing with apologies. But,
right.
You know, that then you have to get the product to the door. Then you have to put it in a bag. Then you have to pay the staff to be there and do it and run the lobster tank. So all of the associated costs that are on top of that, you know, you're just not making anything. So there are a number of products like, crab legs. We stopped selling those because they were so expensive. You just can't ask people to pay that kind of money. Now, fortunately for lobster, that price is coming down and we're seeing, you know, the market adjust a little bit to that. But, you know, there was a period of time there where, you just can't do it. And lobster rolls everywhere are probably $6, $8, $10 higher a piece than they were, you know, a year ago.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing that you guys have going for you, because I know we're feeling it here, like I said, is the fact that it was hard to come by a lot of these items during the pandemic, or I would say last year, really, when there were the shortages of workers and being able to get things shipped into the U.S. So like lobsters, for example, I can remember going to Boston and there were a few places that were serving lobster. Like, so people are willing to pay for it because we haven't had it, but it's painful. You're thinking like, okay, I'll have it once this summer. And that's great. Whereas, you know, on an average summer, you've got people, I would think, coming to your restaurant on a weekly basis to get the same thing. And you know, that's going to impact you. Absolutely. I would think.
Sure, it's an absolute impact on traffic, and you have to adjust and hope that, you know, you can offer people other products that they're going to be able to buy and afford. And but you're right, the things that, you know, summer is known for, you know, lobsters and steamers and all of those things as far as seafood goes, you know, have just become, you know, more expensive and difficult to get. That the inflation, you know, we're talking about restaurants and businesses and residents, but while they're suffering, the state is enjoying a boom because sales tax dollars are collected on those higher costs. So there's hundreds of millions of dollars in excess sales tax money that the state has collected over and above what they need to manage their budget. And, you know, we just think that there's a better way to help people find relief. If we can't do anything about these prices and the government's not doesn't seem to be reacting to it, we're offering a better way. And if people look at abetterwayct.com, some of our Senate policies, our Republican policies, are going to be on there to help people understand what we're trying to do to ease the burden.
We are chatting this morning with State Senator Paul Formica. And we're talking about the amount of money that we're spending on our groceries. So I was watching Channel 3 about a week ago, and they said in their report, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, over the last 12 months, grocery prices have gone up over 13%. That is the largest annual increase since 1979. And we're not talking about, like we were talking earlier about, like lobster. Forget about it. I mean, that's just, forget it. Like the prices of eggs, that's up 38%, flour up 22%, and chicken even up 17%. So for people who are, you know, we're going to talk about what the state of Connecticut is, or rather is not doing. But for people who are thinking, okay, but the president just signed an inflation relief Act into law, and that's supposed to help with inflation. Experts are saying that's actually not really going to help with inflation at all. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, I'm not familiar with the intricacies of that bill, but all of the people that have, you know, reviewed it and talked about it said it just misses the mark in a lot of ways on food inflation. Some of the effects are going to take place late in 2023 and some even in 2025 when it comes to helping prescription drugs, you know, costs going down. You know, we, the Republicans in the state Senate and the House have, you know, tried a different approach. We're trying to do something that takes effect with people right now, things that they could feel a little bit of relief as they're paying these high costs of food. You know, and you talked about the staples, you know, flour and eggs. I mean, you know, people need that to cook any basic item. Mm-hmm. So it really has an effect. So, you know, we put together a plan where we reduced the sales tax. We offered to reduce the sales tax. I said that the higher cost of goods and services increased the sales tax collected, and we're nearly $800 million over collected in sales tax for this year's budget because of those high costs. And we propose to reduce that down from 6.35 to 5.99, eliminate the silly cooked food tax that takes effect on restaurants everywhere and grocery stores on your rotisserie chickens and anything that you buy cooked in the grocery store. We don't think that makes sense. And let's reduce the income tax for working and middle class people from 5% to 4%. Those middle income earners that, you know, would start to see some relief. And yet we've gotten pushback you know, from the other side you know, no acceptance on that. And as you know, yesterday there was a big insurance hearing. You know, the major insurance companies are looking to raise their premium, their cost to consumers, you know, upwards of 20%+. And, you know, at the end of the day, we have to start offering relief. And, you know, I applaud Senator Kelly and Senator Wong down in your area there who have worked awful hard on insurance and health issues. And we've put together a betterwayct.com and affordableconnecticut.com if people want to take a look at some of the policies that we're talking about and join in our call for relief for the people in the state of Connecticut.
So, Senator Formica, I don't think, no matter what side of the aisle, as far as a voter is on, I don't think anyone who goes get money back. That sounds like a horrible idea. I mean, if you do, that just sounds bizarre. But besides giving the states, you know, the sales tax, for example, which we had like 1 week randomly in April, and now we're getting another week sometime this month, which we typically do in Connecticut. So the idea of getting rid of that temporarily for several months has been an idea proposed. Anything else that you think could be done in the here and now to save people money?
Well, the sales tax we talked about reducing, that'll touch everybody because everybody buys goods and services.
Yeah.
The income tax for certain income levels. But, you know, the gas tax, we pushed hard to get the gas tax reduction. That kind of got lost in the shuffle with some of the inflationary impacts that caused the gas to rise. The foreign situation with the war in Ukraine, I think, had a little bit. And also the elimination of the fossil fuel and taking away our energy independence by the federal government, I think, had a big deal. So those are some of the things that we want to do. We want to expand the gas tax holiday to diesel. We know the new truck tax is about to start. You know, and to your point, tomatoes in California, you know, are having trouble. Well, how do those tomatoes from California get everywhere else in the country? They get there by truck, and trucks are powered by diesel. And we think that by including the reduction of the tax on diesel gas and eliminating this truck tax, which is just going to add cost to every case of tomatoes and any other item that comes by truck, and it's going to push inflation up. It's not going to help reduce it.
Senator Paul Formica, can you give that website one more time if people want to learn more?
You want to learn more about our Senate Republican issues and policies? It's betterwayct.com and also affordableconnecticut.com. You spell out Connecticut in that one. It's affordableconnecticut.com or betterwayct.com. You can also look at SenatorKelly.com and SenatorWong.com for issues that affect the area down by where you are in Bridgeport, or if you're listening up here in East Lyme, SenatorFirmica.com. And we all have information on any of those things, and I'm sure we'd all be happy to get back to anybody individually to talk about their specific issues. But, you know, we look forward to an easing of these costs at some point in time, don't you think, Liz?
Hope so. We'll see, right? We'll hope so. Yeah. It certainly is getting every week that I report on the news and you hear about more costs going up in something as simple as like tomatoes, eggs, flour, you know, very basic, but something that's in most of our foods. That's hurting. It's hurting our wallets. It certainly is. So, Senator Formica, I really appreciate you coming on this morning. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having us. And, you know, I wish you and everybody a good and cheaper day than yesterday. How's that?
I like that. Thank you so much, Senator Formica, who proudly serves the 20th District here in Connecticut on WICC. Actor Tom Holland, who is the most recent version of Spider-Man, announced very recently that he's going to just take himself off of social media altogether. He says, I need a mental health break. I got to take care of myself. And, you know, it got me thinking about our mental health and what we can do to better our lives, and if this is a good move for more people to do, which is removing themselves from some of their online platforms. So I thought this morning it'd be a great opportunity to have back on the show Dr. Andre Newfield, who's with Hartford Healthcare. Good morning, Dr. Newfield. Thanks for being here.
Good. How are you? Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here. So first of all, should more of us do what Tom Holland is doing?
You know, I think it comes down to a case-by-case basis. You know, it sounds to me from what Tom was saying that he was struggling when he was hearing feedback online and it would take him to a bad place. So I think if people are having bad reactions to their social media accounts and what's going on the activity there, then certainly so. But I wouldn't say it's a blanket statement for everybody, but certainly studies are coming out that demonstrate that, you know, there are problems for people who are engaging in social media.
I mean, honestly, Dr. Newfield, unless you make it a point to either follow a small group of people or the content you follow is mostly happy, I think it's become more and more common for people to be either attacked or bullied online, which is going to impact anybody's mental health. Wouldn't you agree?
I definitely would.
So the other thing that I wanted to also mention with online presence is I think, you know, you yourself going into a dark place. So like in Tom Holland's case, he's saying I receive really bad content or feedback and that's just impacting me. But sometimes I find that based on what you're following online, it also can change who you are. So maybe you're not being attacked online, but maybe, Dr. Newfield, you could talk about if you are changing as a person online, like you find you're getting angry, you're getting upset, you get frustrated, you get offline and you feel like you're a worse version of yourself than you were when you signed on.
Well, I'd say that that's one risk. I'd also say that, you know, I doubt there are many people that are putting themselves forth on social media that aren't trying to demonstrate some level of them, their best selves. And whenever we're sort of mixing a performance with our regular lives, I think to some degree that's going to offer some distortion and possibly some concerns. But beyond, you know, the originator of that, then you see people that are setting up, you know, sort of these false realities that you're trying to sort of live by or live up to. And that, too, is going to cause problems. And it's this whole sort of false narrative of how we're living that can be very, very disruptive. And so, you know, we have these studies that show that young girls that are online are having body dysmorphia issues, mm-hmm. and certainly their problems with depression and anxiety, you know, trying to possibly relate to that or live up to it. And, you know, that can be very disconcerting and problematic for a lot of users.
We're talking to Dr. Andre Newfield, who is with St. Vincent's Medical Center. He's also the medical director of psychiatry there. And we're talking about mental health and the connection to the online world after a very famous actor decided to pull himself off of social media for a little bit of time just so that he could get his mental health in check. So could you tell us maybe, Dr. Newfield, some warning signs out there if you think that the online world could be impacting you in a negative way?
So I'd say it parallels a lot with any preoccupation that people might have or addiction or abuse sort of scenario where you find that it's impinging upon somebody's time doing other things. And so they're starting to spend exorbitant amounts of time online, and it's taking away from either their studies or their work or some sort of other social engagements in the real world. It's coming along with, you know, a decline in functioning in those other areas, like you're not able to, you know, keep up with, you know, your job, or your grades start declining, or, you know, you're finding that you're having, you know, a lot of disruptions in your social life offline. It also can be accompanied by, you know, signs of depression and anxiety. Either too much or too little sleep, increased or decreased appetite, certainly feelings of suicide or thoughts of suicide, and, increased anxiety. So those are going to be sort of the generalized telltale signs that you want to look for with any preoccupation, including, you know, some sort of social media growing addiction.
So, Dr. Newfield, Tom Holland is 26 years old, and not that age is a factor, but sometimes it can be. I think when you get into your mid to upper 20s and beyond, you're a little more in touch with if you're being impacted negatively or if you're not feeling good about something or you see a change in yourself. What about, like you were saying, especially for young teen girls who are impacted negatively and becoming depressed or have anxiety or have questions about their weight, things like that, just as an example. What do we do for the preteen to teenage users online who may not be able to identify this shift in their mood or their behavior and the impact they could be getting from their social media?
I think it's a great question. And, you know, it's an interesting time in people's lives in sort of early to mid adolescence where, you know, they're sort of becoming more independent, but, you know, they're still children. And I think it's very, very important for parents to sort of be tied in with what's going on. And it's a tough line to sort of strike because you want to foster independence, but at the same time, you still want to parent and make sure that your child is being healthy and making healthy choices. And so I highly recommend that if you're struggling to determine how to parent under those circumstances, that you try to get advice from either a therapist or your pediatrician even, or you know, resources at school and things like that. That's probably key to, you know, determining where that line is and trying to help your child make healthy choices at that point.
Dr. Newfield, I always appreciate having you on. And if you, the listener, you want more information about behavioral health services at St. Vincent's, head on over to stvincents.org. Again, St. Vincent's spelled out .org. And Dr. Newfield, I do appreciate you coming on. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Melissa. And thanks for shedding a light on this really important issue.
Absolutely. Dr. Newfield, always appreciate it. And we'll talk to you again soon. Dr. Newfield with Hartford HealthCare, St. Vincent's Medical Center on WICC.